Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity, helping people learn about lifestyle and complementary approaches to cancer care with proven benefits to well-being and to treatment outcomes. Much of integrative medicine comes under the banner of what's described as mind-body medicine. In fact, you could say that mind-body medicine is the jewel in the crown of the integrative approach. As its potential is only just beginning to be properly appreciated, and it's a science and a discipline that to all intents and purposes is completely absent from conventional care. To my mind, one of the leading voices in mind-body medicine today is Dr. Sam Watts. His understanding of the territory, both scientifically and clinically, is second to none, and his impressive ability to convey that understanding to a wider audience is demonstrated amply in his brilliant new book, The Ayurvedic Approach to Cancer. Hi Sam, great to have you back on the show as always, and with some exciting news for us about your new book that's out this year.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me back on the show. I really appreciate it. It's always good to talk about all things integrative medicine. So yeah, thank you for having me on.
Whenever you're on the show, we always have a great discussion about some aspect of lifestyle and cancer. And I always learn amazing new facts about extraordinary capacities and potential of the body to heal itself. But the great news today is you pulled all your wealth of knowledge and about lifestyle and cancer together, distilled it down into a book, which you published this year under the title The Ayurvedic Approach to Cancer, Engaging Your Body's Powerful Healing Abilities Through Mindset, Diet and Lifestyle. So I've got to say, I love the book for so many reasons. And it's hard to imagine a better starting point for someone wanting to look beyond being a victim of cancer and to inspire and guide them in their first steps towards taking ownership of their situation and their life. So I think for a lot of people, even the title be a bit of a stretch, as cancer is so often seen as the ultimate challenge to our health, requiring the very latest that science and technology has to offer, and not some esoteric ancient potions from India. So what would you like to say to try and persuade even the most cynical to take a look inside your new book?
I think that's always a part of the problem in integrative medicine, isn't it? Is that sense of where does it fit and is it safe and is there evidence base? And I think the biggest not challenge, because the evidence is so compelling, but the main focus for me in writing the book was to bridge together and marry these two worlds and to show that it's not an either or decision. If you're diagnosed with cancer, you know, recently, or if you're listening to this and someone you care for has been, you don't have to put yourself in a box. You don't have to say, I'm either going to be staunchly conventional or I'm going to be staunchly alternative. The whole remit of integrated medicine is that you take the very best of both worlds. And I think that has to happen. I think there's a real danger and a real risk in isolating ourselves and saying, okay, I'm going to take the very, very best of conventional medicine, but I'm going to stop there. I'm going to put all of my hope and all of my, you know, my dreams and survival on something that I have no control over. Conventional medicine is done to you and it's brilliant. And where it's applicable and suitable, you have to take the best of that. But if you stop there, you lose agency. And the aim of what I wanted to do with the book is to say, yes, take the very best of conventional medicine, but empower yourself with evidence-based tools that allow you to be a really active participant in your, ultimately, your journey back to health and to survivorship. And yes, Ayurveda is thousands of years old. And yes, it has lots of lotions and potions, but actually, if you look at the Ayurvedic approach to cancer and you look at it exclusively through the lens of Western clinical published evidence, what you see is a phenomenally powerful, robust, proven practice that can help the body mobilize a profound volume of anti-cancer pathways. So to anyone thinking, should I engage with this? Do it through the lens of the evidence and the research, because it is compelling. It really is. And I think that's a really important message to propagate.
Very well. Well, look, you know, this book is a mine of great information and advice on practical steps you can do to empower yourself. But really, the whole of the first chunk, chapters 1 to 3 and the introduction, are all about something a lot less tangible, really, and they're about getting yourself in the right place in relation to cancer, which is maybe the biggest challenge and the one on which all the practical steps rest, in a way. So I really appreciate the fact you've given the space to it. It's not just a little bit at the beginning. You've actually devoted a good chunk of the book to things like, well, your introduction is called The Insanity of Impossible. And then you have chapters called Choosing Your Own Reality, The Biology of Hope, and Onwards to Imagery. Now, these three together, I think, are fantastic chapters. And really, in a way, they're the jewel of your book, I feel. Because, as I said in the introduction, somebody who's right at the outset, they've got no resources, they're suddenly thrown this curveball, you've got cancer, they've got the prospects of some grueling treatment ahead, their whole future's gone in the bin. They're in a very difficult place indeed, and this stuff really, really matters at that point. So let's start off. I'd just like to go through these three, these four sections, including the introduction. The Insanity of Impossible. What are you on about here?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. There is a big part of the book devoted to this. And it's the most important part because, you know, as I say in the book, I've worked and met and researched something called ECAPs, exceptional cancer patients. I've had the privilege of knowing so many over the years. And The Insanity of Impossible is, I think, a hallmark of what makes an exceptional cancer patient an exceptional cancer patient. They have this ability, you know, the book is suitable for everyone, whether you've got stage 1 cancer, stage 4 cancer, and everything in between. But the research around ECAP, so these ECAPs, these individuals who have a terminal incurable prognosis, who then go on to survive for 5, 7, 10 plus years. That's really important, because if it works in that level of disease burden in terminal stage 4 cancer, it's going to work even more effectively in people with a better prognosis. And the whole concept of the insanity of impossible is when someone looks you in the eyes and says, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Bloggs, your results have come back. You know, you've now got less than 12 months to live and there's not much more we can do for you. Ultimately, what you're given is a situation that's impossible. It's impossible for you to survive. Based upon statistics, based upon my experience, it's impossible. And the single most important thing that has to happen when you're facing that kind of situation is to cultivate a genuine, heartfelt belief in the conscious and subconscious mind that you can survive, that impossible can occur. You can be that individual where something that is impossible becomes possible. And again, we have to lean into the research here, because one of the things that I face a lot, and I'm sure you do as well, Robin, is this idea that, you know, we're preaching false hope and we're giving people hope when there isn't hope. But as my old mentor used to say, as long as there's breath in the body, there's hope. So I haven't met one exceptional cancer patient, whether that's personally, whether it's in the clinical trials, whether it's in the research, who the starting point in their journey to survivorship was built around the cultivation of a belief of, I don't care what you're telling me, I don't care what statistics you put in front of me, I choose my own reality. And that reality is that in 10 years, I'm going to be here. I'm going to be here fit and well. And this is how I'm going to engineer that. And ultimately, they take their reality from a place of impossible, you can't survive, to possible, I can and I will, and this is how I'm going to do it. And it's not the only, obviously the only variable, but it's definitely the most powerful one. Because if you're radicalizing your diet and you're taking the best herbal medicines and you're doing all of the other things that we associate with survivorship, if that's being put into the body that's saying, what's the point? What's the point of doing this? I've been told I'm going to be dead in a year. It's never going to work as well. Whereas if you're doing all these other bits and pieces and they're going into a body which is saturated with the belief that this is possible, I can achieve this, it moves mountains. And that's why the book had to start with that, because, you know, to my mind and the research that supports it, it's the most powerful predictor of exceptional survivorship.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And yeah, I mean, you continually referring to the science, and we must keep looking at the science. And to me, it's fascinating the way that the science actually has moved in favor of lifestyle medicine in such a big way in recent years. And curiously enough, probably the thing that's helped it along the most is the immense, immense investment in genetic research, which makes it possible for us to now see what's happening at a genetic level quite easily. And so now they can actually see the effect that lifestyle measures have on our health and well-being, and how it can actually prompt self-healing mechanisms to kick into action, which is extraordinary. So it's great to me that that is now science. It's moved from woo-woo to science in a relatively short time. Just a matter of a 2 or 3 decades is taken to now be established stuff that actually nobody should be arguing with. Naturally they are, but they shouldn't be, because the science is there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, maybe we can talk a bit more about hope. Because you mentioned it there, and it's a central part there. And as you say, there's all these this talk about, you know, unrealistic hope, and that people shouldn't be given this kind of target to aim for. Is actually unethical to do such a thing. And again, there is this direct connection between our sort of inner stance or our hope in this case and our biology, which is so exciting. And we agree with you, we actually don't really do terminal seems to be just a way of writing people off who are still alive, and where there's life there's hope. So we've seen extraordinary things happen, just like you, over the years. All sorts of people who, you know, even I've thought, oh, blimey, you know, this is the end for somebody. And I was wrong, you know, over and over again. I've been proved wrong. And that's got me to the stage where I'm like, okay, anything goes. Yeah. You never know what's going to happen. And actually, you don't. So, yeah, your chapter is called The Biology of Hope. So you've actually linked these things together quite deliberately. So do you want to say a bit more about that?
Yeah, I just think it's, you know, I hope that in years to come, we get to a point where that idea of terminal, you know, is just the misnomer, because it's such a ridiculous concept. One of the things that I think we've spoken about it before, that they should have almost above the door of every oncology center in the world, is the fact that if you look at the main 140, 150 cancers, which account for probably 95% of all diagnoses every year, there isn't one of those that someone with a stage 4 cancer, terminal, hasn't gone on to survive with, either with that cancer still in their body or, in rarer cases, complete spontaneous remission. And that's not to say that everyone with stage 4 cancer can achieve that, but it is to say that everyone has the potential to. And just knowing that I am living with stage 4 lung cancer, and someone with that prognosis has survived, what bigger beacon of hope can you give someone than that kind of evidence? And it is hope. And, you know, what's so powerful about this is that you go back, you know, over the decades, and the science, the research knew that hope somehow impacted upon survival mechanisms, but it wasn't teased apart. There wasn't causality. How does this mindset alter biochemistry and physiology in a way that is predictive of, you know, healing? But what is fascinating now is that causality has been identified. And, you know, one of the things that one of the most important messages of the book, and I think one of the things that if I had to put it in the top three points, is these neuropeptides that were first discovered by an American doctor called Dr. Candace Pert. And, you know, it was paradigm changing. It literally changed medicine overnight, because what she discovered was in these neural peptides was actually the biology of belief, the biology of hope. They're called the molecules of emotion. So we know that every single cell in the body, every single cell without exception, is able to produce molecules of emotion. It used to be thought that just the brain, just the mind could produce emotions, could produce these molecules. So if we're, you know, say we're diagnosed with cancer, or we experience a recurrence or whatever, and we get this bad news, if our belief system is one of hopelessness and helplessness and disempowerment, that's, yes, that's a mindset, but every cell in the body secretes a molecule of emotion that says, I'm hopeless, I'm helpless, I'm disempowered, particularly all of the systems, the immune system. So what happens to immune cells when they're secreting molecules of emotion that say, what's the point? This is hopeless. This is unhelpless. There's no hope here. Immune function, particularly anti-cancer immune function, drops significantly. So just at the point in your life where you need your immune system to be absolutely the most aggressive, intelligent, system that it can possibly be, just when you need that, it's plummeted into very, very acute states of weakness. But in the same situation, if that immune system is secreting these peptides that say, I'm hopeful, there's always hope here, there's agency, there's things that I can do, there's conventional treatments, I don't care what's put in front of me, I'm going to find a way through this. What happens to immune cells that excrete those emotions is they become aggressive, they become intelligent, they become more numerous, they become more effective. And then the implications of that, the causality between an immune system that's working optimally and how that then relates to the immune cancer paradigm, and how an immune system that's working that way, specifically in the tumor microenvironment, is able to better contain and control and destroy cancer cells, which then obviously has a direct link on survivorship.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
The station that makes you feel good.
When we say the biology of belief, and we talk about hope, we think about it living in the head, and it starts in the head, but it actually exists in every cell in the body, particularly within this immune, within the immune cells and the way they regulate cancer. So this is something now, when we're talking about the biology of belief, this isn't woohoo. It's not quackery. It's hard published science. And it's something that has to be propagated. We need everyone who's diagnosed with cancer or living with cancer to understand that their mindset is going to have a profound impact upon their way their body impacts and regulates and survives in the face of cancer. So it's an important message that this is hard science. It works. We have to learn the tools and the techniques that make our molecules of emotion work for us in an anti-cancer way rather than against us in a pro-cancer way. And that's something that we have agency over. So this is, it's so, so important, which is why I think that these kinds of mindsets are one of the most predictive variables of exceptional survivorship, because it's changing physiology at the base level within this anti-cancer context. So it's really important.
Fantastic. Yeah, there's a couple of thoughts I had on that. There's one is the kind of red flag that maybe should go up the minute sort of certainty about your future is expressed in some way. They do love those things. And actually, nobody's certain about your future. And as you say, you know, there are always people who, however bad the statistics look, actually do fine. And so, those red flags are worth waving and thinking, well, you take that stuff with a pinch of salt. It can be a useful message that your situation is very dangerous, I think. That can actually activate your will to survive. So that can be good. But actually to have certainties about what's going to happen, dangerous stuff. The other thing I was thinking about was that it's worth underlining the fact that in terms of tackling cancer, our own immune system is far and away more effective, clever than anything science has to offer when it comes to getting on top of the disease in any kind of permanent way. It's extraordinary what the immune system can do, but at times it needs help, and that can be something we can do, as you're saying, in a multitude of ways, which science has told us about, everything from the practical to the seemingly esoteric can support our own immune system in doing the job much better than anybody else could.
Yeah, and I think it is, and it's something that I find, you know, perpetually frustrating, because like you said, I don't think there's never probably going to be a magic bullet, is there, for cancer, you know, in the sense that we perceive it as a simple treatment and cure. But if anything was to ever get close to that, it's going to come from within. You know, I used to work with an immunologist at the hospital, and that's what she used to say. It still astonishes her just how profound the human immune system is when it comes to cancer containment. You know, if you take an individual immune cell and an individual cancer cell and you connect them, it's unequivocal. It's not even a battle, really. The immune cell will always, always overcome a cancer cell. It's just that cancer has developed and evolved very complex mechanisms to evade and to smoke and mirror the environment so that the immune cells can't find it. But if we look at the immunotherapy from the pharmaceutical perspective, but we also look at it in terms of lifestyle and diet, herbal medicines, we know that every time we do something that increases not just immune counts, but particularly immune surveillance, the ability of immune cells to find cancer cells and their aggressiveness when they do, the more we build that level of robustness in our immune system within the tumor microenvironment, I'm not aware of anything that will mobilize a better response to cancer and survivorship than that. And that's something that we have such unbelievable agency over. You know, our sleep, actually everything we do over a 24-hour cycle, our circadian alignment, when we get up, the foods we eat, the mindsets we cultivate, the exercise we get, the relationships we nurture, the herbal medicines and supplements we take, everything, sitting outside in a forest for half an hour. You know, that's been clinically proven to not just increase natural killer cell counts, but their actual activity against breast cancer cells. So we every day, you know, one of the things I always talk about is when we go to bed at night, we should be able to look ourselves in the mirror and say, I have done a multitude of things today that have stimulated not just immunity, but anti-cancer immunity. You do that day after day, and suddenly you can see how these exceptional cancer patients become exceptional, because they're creating an environment that is essentially making it so overwhelmingly difficult for cancer to do what it wants to do. And the immune system is one part of that, but it's a particularly potent and a particularly important part. And yes, there are lots of external things we can do, like forest bathing and like herbal medicines and conventionally immunotherapy. But the immune system still built from within. It's an inside out job. And that's where things like our circadian alignment and our belief systems, and stress, stress is one of the biggest suppressors of immunity. So we have to build it from the inside out and then nourish it from the outside in. If we do that, I think the sky is genuinely the limit with what we can achieve. And there's such an emerging science around that, which is really exciting and really empowering, I think.
Amazing. And just like to point out that all those marvelous immune building strategies you just described there are included in your book, of course. Yes, in the ensuing chapters. So that's great. I thought it'd be useful to just give people a sense of the background, because it's one of the things about human beings is what they're used to, they don't really notice. And, you can have grown up in a very abusive family, for example, and think that's normal because that's what you're used to. Mm. And, I was totally shocked recently to be given statistics about the mental health of the UK. Now, this is a background thing that we're working with, and many of the strategies that you've got in your book will directly counter this. But just to show how important they could be, we got this epidemic of isolation caused by all sorts of things, social media, austerity, community and family fragmentation, all sorts of things. So the Mental State of the World Report 2024, the UK out of 82 countries surveyed is bottom, along with Ukraine. Okay.
Was it actually? I hadn't seen that.
Bottom. I mean,
that's horrific.
It just knocked me sideways when I heard that. Ukraine, well, you can look at the outside from the outside and say, well, there's lots of reasons for people's mental health to be bad in Ukraine. But there we are alongside them in the UK. Now, when that's the backdrop that we're used to, it's difficult to see where we're starting from and how crucial it could be to tackle our mental outlook, the way we see things. Particularly when you couple that with the fact that we're one of the world leaders in poor health when it comes to chronic conditions here as well. We're right up there. And so the health of the nation has never been worse, really, from a point of view of chronic disease. So that's where we're starting from. And so we're going to plow a very different furrow to the one that most of society has been going along. If we want to find a way towards genuine health and well-being. And your book, of course, is rammed with exactly the kind of things that we're, as a society, doing wrong and the means.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
The station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, do you want to maybe just build on that a little bit in terms of this whole sort of downward drive of society we've had in the last 100 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's depressing. I mean, I hadn't seen that statistic, which is, I mean, that is unimaginably bad. I mean, that's catastrophic, isn't it, for a country like the UK to be on the same level as a war torn,
a political crisis.
And you can see, I mean, that's terrifying in terms of the right here, right now, people living in that space. But you play that forward over the coming years and you think about the links between that kind of mental platform, that emotional health and well-being platform, and then disease risk. So there was a very famous study done on the west coast of the States. And they looked, they surveyed, I think, about 155,000 newly diagnosed cancer patients. And they wanted to see, they literally asked them to go back the 16 months prior to their diagnosis. And 82% of them had experienced a significant life stressor in the 16 months prior or earlier prior to diagnosis. And what they were showing was that that life stressor and the anxiety and the stress and the overwhelm it caused was, you know, probably mechanistically linked, not in isolation, but as part of a reason why cancer was allowed to develop. Because, you know, we know that when we're experiencing stress, anxiety, depression, overwhelm, you know, the immune system is compromised in an unimaginable way, possibly to a point that it allows a cancer burden that would have been identified and destroyed to become more rapidly growing, to essentially evade destruction. And then you look at the links between, if we're living in a society where that many people are experiencing bad mental well-being, you know, on a level with a war-torn country, the implications of that on health down the line is I can't almost compute that in my mind, how catastrophic that potentially is. But on the other side of the coin is the good news, which is actually everything we need to take control of our mental health and mental well-being is typically free, and it's easy to harness with just a little bit of signposting. You know, meditation, for example, you know, there is an abundance of free resources. You know, in terms of the clinical evidence, there's probably no better practice for countering the negative effects of stress and anxiety than there is a contemplative activities. And the beauty of that is that when you come out of those practices, the stress, you know, whether it's grief or divorce or money problems, those stresses are still there. But what you've done is you put a much lower ceiling on the damage that they can cause through the changes in the body that practices like meditation induce. Time out in nature. Again, you know, in Japan now, Japan had one of the worst public health profiles in the world, not just in the West. You look at the suicide rates, the depression rates, and they had to find a way out of that. And they stumbled across this forest bathing practice where you, every time a GP gave out a prescription, they had to give out a green prescription. Here are your blood pressure meds, but you need to go and, you know, to a forest bathing park, and you need to do the practices. And within 10 years, Japan went from having the worst mental health public health profile to now having one of the best, because forest bathing is so embedded into their culture. And we now know that time spent in the natural world changes the biochemistry of the brain, the hormone profile in the body, the immune status. So again, that's free. Listening to birdsong has now been clinically proven to reduce cortisol. So all of these, you know, exercise, all of these things that we need, if you're struggling with mental health or emotional well-being for whatever reason, the ability to one, overcome that, or even less so, but still important, to minimize the risk that that problem's having on your physiology and your disease risk factors. It's so empowering to know that we can do things. And like I said, most of these practices are free, and they're usually quite enjoyable to do. So what we need, we do need a paradigm change. We need things to shift in the UK to, you know, we are suffering. There is austerity, and there are all these problems we're facing as a community and a society. But in spite of those, it's not acceptable for us to accept a level of mental health in our country at that, and in at that level of severity. Here's how we counter it. Here's how we can embed evidence-based practices to give people control over their mental well-being, even when there are problems that they're facing. And that's, I think, a really important message that needs to be propagated.
Yeah, it's very empowering. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's all the ingredients there to show why we're in such a state because of all the directions things have gone. But as you say, there's very accessible ways in which we can start to get things right. And of course, the marvelous story with Japan there, because it shows you just how much impact these things can have. So despite the mess around us, we can start moving in a new direction, and it will majorly affect our health, well-being, whole life, in fact. So that's a wonderful story. And with the Ayurveda, I mean, all these things are in Ayurveda already, and they've been there for thousands of years, you know, about good living, you know, how to live well, basically. And it's fascinating to me the way we've been this huge arc, which has been to, we started in this place, a lot of those things must have been just known intuitively. Nobody questioned them. They were maybe just obvious at the time.
Yeah.
We've moved from this huge arc. We've gone further and further and further and further away from that. And we've suffered as a result. But actually, the science is producing the doorway to go back in and find out, oh, yeah, they had it right back those thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
Here's the evidence to show that they actually had it right.
Yeah.
And so it's a different doorway for us. And we need that in a way. We've changed in that time, and now we need that kind of mental underpinning of the common sense that science brings to things to demonstrate. Yeah, this is, we can see this thing works. There's Japan has showed us the evidence that this one practice can change a level of mental health at a societal level. Is extraordinary. And you know, we do need that stuff now, but it's there in spades. So
yeah. And it's really interesting because, you know, forest bathing as we know it is this Japanese term, but actually, like you say, in Ayurveda, so ashrams, you know, people think about ashrams as these, you know, spiritual meditation retreats, but you go back further than that. An ashram translates as a forest academy. So what ashrams were originally were people, they're called householders, people in active normal life, families, jobs. As opposed to monks and mystics, they were a place for people to disengage with all of the demands of life and retreat into nature for a complete rejuvenation. This is going back, you know, pre-industrial. Even then, they realized we have to take a break from the stresses and strains of normal life. And that's what ashrams were. They were a forest academies, places to get into nature and to heal and rejuvenate and to have quietude and to rebalance. And actually, the symbol of Ayurveda came from that. So the symbol of Ayurveda is a lotus flower. And, you know, they spend their whole life in water. They never get wet because they're like, you know, a duck's back. As soon as you put water onto the flower, it just flows off. And they talks about that's what we should be in life. We should be in the world, but not touched by it. And it's a beautiful concept. It's very hard to do, but this idea that, yes, we have good days and bad days. We have, you know, healthy years and unhealthy years. We have all of these dualities in our lives. But if we can progress through life maintaining agency, this bad thing has happened. I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to maintain a sense of inner peace and balance whilst doing it through these tools. And whatever it is, and it's a really powerful message. And one of the books I always advocate when people ask me what books to read when they're, you know, newly diagnosed with cancer or whatever, I always talk about a book called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. One of the best books I've ever read. You know, he was a doctor and a psychoanalyst in the concentration camps in Germany. And he talks about this final freedom that in whatever situation you face, you have the ability to choose how you respond. And in choosing how you respond, you change your reality. And the power of his message is that if that model worked in the baseness of the concentration camps, it will probably work anywhere else. And that's what this is about. It's about saying, yes, we all have these huge challenges in life and these huge problems, particularly when we're facing an illness, particularly a life-threatening illness or a potentially life-threatening illness. But despite all those bombs going off around us, do we have the ability, can we learn the skills to say, okay, yes, I'm in this position, but I have the empowerment and the agency and the commitment and the willpower and the sheer devil-may-care attitude that I will dominate and control this situation. I will create my own reality. And in creating it, we change it. And it's suddenly, rather than be floundering in a situation where we feel completely lost and overcome with uncertainty and fear, we claw back a sense of I can shape this reality to how I need it to go. And just getting up in the morning with that sense of agency changes the whole outlook. do that over, 365 days, you've changed the year. And when we're living with cancer, that's what needs to happen. So these things, they sound like outliers when we look at it as the bigger picture, but actually they're not, they're center. Because examples, we know that when people have chemotherapy and they approach chemotherapy with a positive attitude, they have a clinically significant reduction in side effects compared to people having the same chemotherapy at the same dose who are going into it with a sense of disempowerment and fear. So this changes everything. And it's so frustrating because these are simple to do techniques. They're simple learned skills and they should be front and center. They're not. They're very much the known by very few people. So it's a real problem at the moment.
Mm. Yeah. So, mind body medicine, which is under the banner you've been working on it for years. It's made huge strides, but as you say, it's got a lot further to go in terms of its real recognition. Things like the fact we know, for example, that our social and personal connections are the biggest predictor of our longevity. That should be at the heart and center of any nation's public health strategy, shouldn't it? Really?
Yeah.
Because that's...
Yeah, it should.
But it's nowhere near it. It's not even on the radar.
No.
But what an important thing to know, for us to know, because as I say, if we're suffering as a nation from social isolation, which we are, then, there you go. That's a way to shorten your life, basically. And we're somebody with cancer, we're very concerned with lengthening our lives. So that's a place to look. But, it seems that almost every health issue has these two doorways to me. You can just about always come at it from the physical side, and it makes sense. There are things you can do. You can do this practice. You can take this herb. You can do whatever it is, But then there's the other side you can come in, which is the spiritual, emotional, mental side. And that's just as powerful, just as meaningful, just as relevant. And either of them could work on its own in some circumstances. Mm. But imagine if you do both at the same time.
Yeah, that's got to be the holy grail, isn't it?
Yeah. You do everything, basically. And integrative medicine, that to me is what it means. It means you do everything.
Yeah.
You no stone unturned. And so that's your territory and your bringing and backing the science of mind-body medicine continually. And not least of all, of course, through this fantastic new book.
Yeah, and I think, I absolutely agree that the best is when we do the physical and the kind of the internal and the external work. But I definitely, I don't want to caveat this by saying we still need both. But I've personally met individuals who become exceptional, who put much more focus on the inner world. They've still done the outer stuff, but their focus initially has been very much, how do I engineer my internal environment in a way that's bulletproof? And they've done stuff on the outside, diet and herbs and this, that, and the other, but to a lesser degree. But I've never met or worked or researched with an exceptional cancer patient the other way around, who has moved mountains on the outer world. They've radicalized everything, diet, herbs, exercise, sleep, all of it, but who hasn't really put an equal or greater emphasis on the inner world. And that could just be a coincidence with the people that I've met or worked with. But my kind of hunch is that we have to stack this the right way. We've got to get the inner dialogue and the inner outlook and the hope and the desire. There's a big difference between not wanting to die and wanting to live. And it's a subtle difference, but a profound one biochemically and physiologically. I think if we get the foundation, I think it's like building a house. You could build a house with the strongest walls and the strongest roof, but if the foundations are weak, it's not going to hold up. But if we build a super strong house with super strong roofs and walls on a super strong foundation, that's where it becomes impregnable. And the foundations are what is occurring in our inner belief system and dialogue and expectations and hopes and dreams and goals. Get that lined up, get that bulletproof, then overhaul the outer world. And suddenly you're moving into a very, very, you're moving into rare air. And that's not to say that one is more important than the other, but I think there is a hierarchy of how you go about addressing those. And I think that's what integrated medicine.
Very interesting. Yeah, I'm with you there on the hierarchy, because it's the inner relationship to what you're doing creates the environment for the decisions you make in a practical way, and therefore the practical decisions you make for your well-being will change as a result of your inner alignment. And yeah, I agree with that. And also, I think the societal leaning towards the outer, the practical, the mechanical, all of that for thousands, or certainly hundreds of years, has put us in a position where, in fact, we need to move our attention onto the other side. We've actually not been looking. That's why we're in the mess we're in with our mental and physical health. So it's kind of like, as a society, obvious that that's the place where we should start. So right with you there. Fantastic. We're out of time. I want to encourage everybody to buy The Ayurvedic Approach to Cancer by Dr. Sam Watts. Great book. Marvelous for the people who are, you know, really in difficulty and newly diagnosed with cancer, particularly. So thanks so much for coming on the show today, Sam.
No, thank you for having me, Rob. It's always an absolute pleasure. So yeah, thank you for inviting me on.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Dr. Watts' well-founded passion for bringing the hope inherent in mind-body medicine to as many people with cancer as possible is unavoidable. I absolutely love his new book and will be recommending it strongly going forward. To read more about Dr. Watts' work or to order a copy of his book, go to his website, which is mind-body-medical.co.uk. That's mind-body-medical.co.uk. Thanks so much for listening today. I look forward to bringing you another Yes to Life show next week here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.
To modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.